Our speaker today is, of course, Sunil Mukhi, and his talk is entitled "Gauge and Grain Couplings of Non-Commutative Grains to Remote-Remote Backgrounds."
Thanks. Well, it's always a great pleasure to be here. And in this talk, which has an ambitious 7 sections, I will try to summarize some of the work that I've been doing in Kerala over the last 6 or 7 months. Is there a pointer?
Yes.
In collaboration with my graduate student, Nimani Suryanarayana at the Tata Institute. And the plan of my talk is as follows. After a little bit of review, I'll briefly summarize the results in this first paper, which was written last September, in which we discussed in DBI, or constant field approximation, how to couple closed string Ramond-Ramond modes to the modes on a brain with non-commutativity. Then I'll review some material largely due to Hong Liu and Sumit Das and Sandeep Trivedi, which will help us to pursue the rest of the problem, which is how to generalize these couplings to the case of spatially varying fields. And we'll see that when we have spatially varying fields, then gauge invariant operators are a lot more complicated to construct. However, we will succeed in constructing them, and we'll find a few interesting byproducts, such as exact expression for the Seiberg-Witten map in the U1 case, and a few other mathematical identities. And I dare say that there are still a few more buried inside this formalism somewhere, which should be extracted. This part has significant overlap with recent papers by Okawa and Oguri, and a forthcoming paper by Liu and Michelson, both of which have exactly the same expression for the Seiberg-Witten map and the other key identity that I'll be presenting here. This one is already out last week, just before ours, and this one I'm told is due out very soon.
Tomorrow, hopefully.
Okay, tomorrow. And this one I'm told will also, actually what's interesting is that our approach here, first of all, I think it is quite amusing that 3 independent papers all have one author here at ITP. I guess it's nice that we could all meet and talk with each other. Also, by now I've read all of them, and it's interesting that they all take somewhat different points of view and do slightly different things, although the key result of this is the same. In particular, Liu and Michelson have done disk amplitude calculations, which were not done in either this paper or ours, which sort of motivate their results, and I'm told that will appear in the 3rd episode of Star Trek sometime in the future. Okay. After that, if it isn't evening already, I'll try and briefly summarize the extension of these results to the case of D-brains of non-maximal dimension, i.e. less than 9, in which case there are transverse scalars, and we'll find interesting analogs of Seiberg-Witten maps and stuff like that for transverse scalars, and we'll also briefly extend our results to non-BPS brains which have tachyons. Now, for ordinary BPS D-brains, I realize a little the irony of saying ordinary BPS D-brains, since only 6 years ago at this time there wasn't any such thing, but by now everyone knows what ordinary BPS D-brains are. And of course, the key point when they were discovered was that they couple to Ramond-Ramond fields. Soon thereafter, it was discovered that they couple not just to the field which is responsible for their stability, but to all lower Ramond-Ramond fields, which couplings were interpreted as the phenomenon of brains within brains. And later, much later in fact, it was discovered that they also coupled to higher Ramond-Ramond fields, which has led to a number of interesting dynamical effects that people have been studying. And to summarize, in a formula, this thing here, where Cn is the sum, formal sum over all Ramond-Ramond fields in the type 2 string theory, F is the world volume field strength, B is the space-time B field, and as Myers taught us, we should put all this stuff in a square bracket. We have here an exponential of some kind of dot products with matrix-valued transverse scalars, and then we should pull back the whole thing to the world volume of the brain. Yes?
formula also can be generalized to include the curvature.
That's, yeah, I guess I wrote that there.
Okay.
Yeah. Indeed. So there's an A roof genus factor over here. The point there, however, is that these are couplings to modes which are bulk modes, but the couplings are localized on the brain. So couplings between the graviton and the Raman-Ravon field, which are localized on the brain. It might be interesting to study them, but offhand I wouldn't know what non-commutativity would have to say. Of course, it would in a sense because I'm, okay, never mind. The whole idea was to ignore it. Okay, and this notation is that you expand this stuff, and wherever an I-phi hits a C, you start sequentially from the leftmost index of C, dotting it with the upper index of phi. And at the end of the day, whatever you collect from here should be a form of the dimension of the brain, world volume. Yes?
Well, C is going to vary. I guess maybe this is what you're going to talk about. There are ordering problems, right?
There could be ordering problems.
Ordering for a matrix, so now you have to take...
That is true.
C has an analytic expansion in X.
That is correct. That is correct. So I'm not going to answer it except to say that from what I understand, you use the symmetrized trace wherever there's an ordering problem, and I'm not actually completely sure what better anyone knows to
do. Well, actually, in my paper, we talk about there was a derivation where the original symmetric trace prescription was proposed in the paper by, and actually derived it, deducing the paper by what the Ramstone. From one computation, use the resulting sensor which gives the coupling to satisfy the engaging barrier of Raman-Ramon field to all orders.
So you take symmetrized trace.
Symmetrized. Certainly, yeah.
And so the way we proved it was that we can show that symmetrized trace prescription is equivalent to tau ordering of. So if you compute the amplitude in this amplitude, then there is an operator, auto-string operator inserted on the boundary. And then there is a tau ordering, where tau is a coordinate on the boundary. And then we proved in one of our appendix to all, for any number of operators, auto-string operators, tau ordering prescription is equivalent to the symmetrized prescription. So therefore, proves that the symmetrized prescription is the correct one when it involves only DT. But when it involves only CP without DT. However, for gravitational background, it's more subtle.
Okay.
Well, also, there's some sort of trace prescription in the context of the original DBI terms. There are still issues with that.
Yeah.
That's...
Well, we proved this in the context of the Zeiberg-Witten limit, in the case of non-commutativity, or equivalent to the DKP limit. If you go away from that, the situation is likely to be more subtle.
Okay.
It actually follows immediately in the non-commutative case from just the way in which the open string operators are constructed using Wilson lines. The symmetry automatically falls out.
That's right. Okay. Now, there are also in principle derivative corrections to this formula. For example, if just to give a specific example, if you had a 9 brain and you picked out C, the 8 form, wedge F, a 2 form to make the 10 form on the 9 brain, then that could have corrections of the form C wedge, something which was made out of derivatives of several Fs with some contractions, so it would involve metrics, and it would be of course an alpha prime correction. And that correction, which is what we'll call the two-form correction, can be absorbed, according to a result of Willard last year, can be absorbed in a field redefinition of the world volume gauge field. Okay. On the other hand, if I take a term like C6 wedge F on the 9 brain, so that's a four-form F wedge F, that can have derivative corrections which have been computed by Willard and which are apparently not absorbable as field redefinitions. And so in that case, one will have to be quite careful because there are some corrections that one hasn't taken into account. Of course, one might take alpha prime to zero to get rid of them. But if you want to work for general alpha prime, then from a Raman-Ramon form, which is dimension 4 less than the brain world volume onwards, you'll have derivative corrections. quite a bit is known about them, but of course, at least in low orders in alpha prime. So they are actually computed and quite interesting. But that again is something I won't discuss here. Okay, so the problem to be posed here is, let's turn on a constant B field background in space-time along the brain world volume, and let's ask the question, what is the analog of this formula in non-commutative variables? And this question, except that this, not this, but the DBI action was the starting formula. This question was addressed, of course, by Cyborg and Witten in their classic paper and by many other authors at a similar time. And we know that a number of interesting results came out of it. So all we are saying is that you can ask the same question exactly for the Chern-Simons Lagrangian, Chern-Simons terms in the Lagrangian, and one should just see what comes out. As you'll recall, Meyer's classic analysis also was done keeping Chern-Simons and DBI actions in parallel. Somehow they have very similar properties, although they look very different. Okay, so I've already said one. The Chern-Simons action is responsible for interesting physical effects on a D-brain, such as anomaly inflow, the existence of bound states between different D-brains of differing dimensions, for example, the dielectric effect, and so on. So, can these effects be described nicely in non-commutative variables, or can there be new effects which are visible more easily in these variables? This, a sort of byproduct in a sense, is that you get interesting mathematical identities in non-commutative field theory, and I have to say that for the longest time, one of the identities that we got, and which was independently obtained by the other two groups, I mean, one couldn't quite see why it should be there. It just happens to pop out as a byproduct of this investigation. And although there are now proofs, we've given a proof in some cases, and Ogri and Okawa have given a nice proof using operator language. It's still not quite sort of clear that the whole story of why it should be there has been uncovered. That's the first identity I'll show you. The second identity, on the other hand, turns out to be the Cyborg-Witten map, and we do know why it's there. Cyborg and Witten told us that. But this gives a closed form expression, which was previously conjectured by Liu. Now, I'll break the problem into two parts, which are exactly the two papers I'm reporting on. First, the discussion of Ramon-Ramon couplings when you have constant fields, which is the analog of the DBI approximation in the Chern-Simons action. And then we'll go to spatially varying fields. And eventually we'll generalize to unstable non-BPS brains at the end. And these two papers, which also more or less appeared simultaneously in last November and have a lot of overlapping content, were extremely useful to us, particularly in the second part of our investigation. In fact, I think this paper suggested what we've done as a homework problem. So we've actually done it. Okay, so the starting point for this discussion, the discussion here is presented slightly in the reverse order from the way we've done it in the paper. The idea is start with nd instantons, and of course there's no integral in that case. The trace is only over the n by n matrices, and this is all you have because there's no b and there's no f along the instanton. And you're supposed to expand this out and keep the zero form part. And the idea of matrix theory is that we can take some or all of the phis, call them x's, and let x's be infinite by infinite matrices with this commutator. And if really this theta has maximal rank, then the result has to be a D9 brain, possibly with induced lower brain charges. Now you can parameterize the fluctuations around the classical solution small x in this way, suggestively. At this point, theta is just what you chose as the commutator of x's, and a hat is a one form that you introduce just to make this definition. In that case, if you check the commutator of capital X's, you find that it's a new object q, which starts with theta but has an extra term theta, f hat theta, where f hat is the non-commutative field strength made from a hat with the star commutator appearing here. So in this sense, we really build up non-commutative field theory starting from something which was just nd instantons. Okay, the star commutator is a consequence of this. And the star product appearing here is the famous Moyal product. Now, What we can do then, since Q is nothing but the commutator of X's and X's are phi's, I'm sorry, so much notation. These are the phi's, the transverse scalars, all the scalars in fact, on the d-instanton. And we've set the phi's to be equal to X's parameterized in this way. It means that the commutator of X, which is Q, is the same as I phi, which sits up there, except for a factor of 2. So we can make this replacement. I remind you that I phi is contracted with an antisymmetric object, so it's as good as its own commutator. So you can make this replacement and rewrite the d-instantons in this language. The only thing new is that we've replaced I phi by I of Q. Q is the commutator of phi's or x's. Now this can be rewritten in a very simple way. Introduce the Pfaffian or square root determinant of the matrix Q, which is this. And it's an easy exercise to check that the trace of e to the minus half iq contracted with the Ramon-Ramon fields and keeping only the zero form part is the same as what's on the right side keeping only the 10 form part. This involves sort of Poincaré duality, but that's what you have to do. Basically, it's quite simple. You expand this and you could have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 powers of iq. That comes from expanding this Pfaffian, which has all 5 powers, if you like, and then removing one by one the powers you get by expanding the exponential. It's quite a simple and short exercise. And Q inverse is the matrix inverse of Qij, and we represent it here as a two-form. Now, it's actually very easy to do all this in a basis where Q, in the special basis for the antisymmetric matrix Q, where it just has components Q1, 2, Q3, 4, and so on. But with a few epsilons, you can do it more generally. Okay. And once we've got it in this form, we find a nice little surprise, which is that Q inverse is actually equal to B plus F. I should remind you of the definition of Q. This is the definition of Q. And it's quite easy to do this manipulation. Q inverse is 1 over this matrix. You can split it up into these two pieces. And for constant field strengths F hat, this piece is just F. This is the Seiberg-Witten map for constant fields. And 1 by theta is defined to be B in this formalism because we've built up brains without actually knowing what system we were building up. And it is the B field in terms of the parameter theta in a special description of non-commutative field theory, which is otherwise called the background independent or phi equals minus B description. Okay. Now with all that, and this formula that I just derived for you, our proposal is that the Ramon-Ramon couplings in non-commutative variables for constant fields are given by this. Okay. All the stuff about all the stuff with e to the I phi on d instantons has been summarized in Pfaffian of Q and e to the Q inverse by an identity I showed you before. And Q is an object defined entirely in terms of non-commutative objects, theta and f hat. And it's background independent. Okay. And the last step we made in going from here to here was to replace the trace over d instanton matrices by an integral by which we gain this Pfaffian of theta, and we also gain enough 2 pi's to convert the tension from mu minus 1 to mu 9. And that's the proposed action, Chern-Simons action, on non-commutative, coupling non-commutative brains to RR fields. It's actually very simple. It isn't really anything more than rewriting the terms derived originally by Van Ramsdonk, Taylor, and Myers. But it looks nice and it has some interesting consequences. Okay.
Do you think this will also be true on the torus?
On the torus. You mean just on a space-time torus?
Yeah.
Yes, why not? What?
Oh, because the non-commutative algebra is different.
Ah, the algebra being different. Mm-hmm. Well, so it's a kind of exponential of this.
It's a canonical trace, but it's no longer the obvious myon algebra.
Well, of course, conventional wisdom says that once you have this action, I see your point. But do we need to use the algebra anymore once we have this? I see. You're asking what would happen to the Moyal product in the Lagrangian.
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah,
know is the algebra of functions on Rn, my all product, is not the same as
Surely.
The torsion.
Yeah, you'd have to exponentiate this in some sense, right, to get the torus algebra. Okay. That is, yeah.
The torus vector was written down. Schwartz?
No, that's part of what I'm asking.
Yeah.
Well, nevertheless, for example, this is consistent with T-duality, which does require it to be wrapped on a torus. So there are some indications. So there was actually a nice paper just after us by Radu Tatar, who showed that when you T-dualize the system, very simple system that we considered here, you find a slanted torus where theta parameterizes the slant of the torus, and a slanted brain on that where Q parameterizes the angle of the brain. It's very pretty, actually. And so this ratio is just some kind of trigonometric thing from the angle of the brain over the angle, sine maybe, sine of the angle made by the brain over sine of the angle made by the torus itself. And that's it. It's very nice. So it does work.
Isn't another way of saying that it should still work on the torus is that you can just do a gauge transformation to get rid of B, and then you know you have the usual commutative version with all the couplings, and then just transform back to the
instrument. Hmm.
You do have infinite dimensional representation also on the torus, right? Besides the original finite dimensional.
Poor question.
Yeah. So the infinite dimensional one this will work, right?
Well, in fact, there are many in equivalent modules in the non-commutative
torus.
It's much richer.
Okay, well, fine. Now, how about the equivalence of this? You see that here I've just replaced Q inverse by B plus F. That's a funny thing because, okay, of course, in general, it's Q inverse. It only becomes B plus F when the field strengths are constant. That's when Q inverse is B plus F. But in that limit, this is just the usual Chern-Simons action, or the part of it that we need on a 9-brain. Well, on a 9-brain, this is everything because there are no pullbacks and there are no transfer scalars. So what's this factor doing? Well, this factor just is equal to 1 plus total derivative terms in the DBI approximation because these terms depend on F hat, which is assumed constant. And you can compare actually this formula with this one, which is obvious to derive but was actually written down last year, I think, by Seiberg in his paper on background independence from matrix theory, in which the DBI action in non-commutative variables is written using the closed string coupling, the closed string metric, no open string quantities here, and the only new thing that happens is that B plus F, which should have been here, is replaced by Q inverse, and you get this factor. Okay, so in that sense, you can see that this action and this action are obtained from their commutative counterparts by a very simple prescription. Wherever you see B plus F, put in Q inverse, and wherever there's an integral, put a factor of Pfaffian Q upon Pfaffian theta, and that's the end of it for the DBI approximation. Okay, now with lower dimensional brains, you find something that you might expect. If you make a lower dimensional brain out of matrices, say a 7-brain, then it will have two transverse scalars. Now, even if you make a single 7-brain, it will have two transverse scalars which are not matrices in that sense, but they'll still multiply each other with the star product because the 7-brain will be non-commutative. And because of that, the Myers type of interaction, as it's written here, is not with a matrix, not with matrices, but with stars, which is sort of the same thing. But here it's a single 7-brain with transverse scalars. And this may lead you to worry that we are going to get an unphysical result at the end, because a single 7-brain certainly does not couple to the Ramon-Ramon 10 form. Right? You need a bunch of 7-brains in order to couple to the Ramon-Ramon 10 form. On the other hand, this suggests that a single 7-brain does couple to the 10 form, because here's the 10 form embedded in this, and you can contract two indices with that, and you seem to have a coupling. And this is a paradox that we'll resolve later. It turns out, first of all, that this that coupling is zero in the DBI approximation in which I've written this, but more importantly, it's exactly zero in the exact expression which I'm going to write later. Okay. Just to explain the paradox again, take a 7-brain, turn on a B-field on its world volume. that seems to make the 7-brain non-commutative, so it makes its transverse scalars non-commutative. So they apparently couple it to the 10 form. This shouldn't happen because the 7-brain, even with a B field, shouldn't couple to the 10 form if it's just one brain. That's the paradox. But it's a small one and it will be resolved.
Why shouldn't this couple to 7-form?
Because it's not a bunch of N 7-brains. You really need N. In the commutative description, you need at least 2 7-brains to have a commutator coupling. I'm comparing it to the commutative case, yes. I mean, because both are physically the same. You just take the brain and turn on a B field. Physically, they're the same. However, if you like, this is an example of the kind of identities we'll be finding. You see, we just saw what seemed to be a paradox. So something must be zero which doesn't look zero, and that's the kind of identity which we'll find. Okay, brief review of what you should do when you have spatially varying Ramon-Ramon fields and gauge field strengths. And the answer, which started from, I believe, an old paper by Iso, Ishibashi, Kawai, and Kitazawa, I think, and then has been explored by a number of authors last year, including Gross, Hashimoto, Itzaki, Dasen, Sujangre, and others, is that we need to introduce open Wilson lines if we want to have a gauge invariant coupling whenever a field is spatially varying. And the open Wilson line that we need in non-commutative field theory is the path ordered with respect to the star product exponential of the gauge field running along a particular contour parameterized by psi I of tau. Tau goes from 0 to 1. So it's a straight line contour. You could have others, but it's best, it's most convenient to use the straight line contour.
But it is a straight open Wilson line that is cut with close to each state.
I believe that's the content of these people's work. That's right. Where you integrate this from 0 to 1 along this contour, and the important thing is that the direction of this straight contour is fixed entirely by the non-commutativity theta ij and the momentum kj that you want to consider. So in a sense, this is not really, it looks like just a function of position. What you need is to fix this momentum and then Fourier transform it to a mode with that momentum, and then that's going to be gauge invariant. And the manipulations by now are very well known. The Wilson line transforms like any open Wilson line with different matrices at the two ends, where this one is evaluated at the end point of the line. However, this matrix, when passing through e to the I k dot x, gets shifted back to its original location because of non-commutativity of x with the argument there. And the result is that this Wilson line, as defined here, Fourier transformed with momentum k and evaluated and integrated, is gauge invariant for every k. So this is, of course, just a fact. As Hiroshi just said, it's now actually shown from matrix theory that that's the object you need to couple to background fields if you want to extend the couplings from constant fields to spatially varying fields in a gauge invariant way. And this is the content of that statement. Given local operators OI of X, all of which transform in the adjoint, we'd like to make a gauge invariant operator out of their product. And what we are instructed to do by Liu and Das and Trivedi is to take this and insert it here along with an open Wilson line, put a bracket and a path order with respect to the star product, everything inside, which does mean also you expand out the Wilson line itself and path order everything there. And the other part of their prescription is that the argument of these operators is located not at the beginning or at the end of the Wilson line, but actually everywhere, all along the Wilson line. This corresponds to smearing its location on the Wilson line, and correspondingly there are these operators, these integrals in the parameters tau I. So you have as many tau I's as operators that you've inserted. But in addition, the Wilson line has exponential with an integral with a tau, and when you expand that, you'll get many more tau integrations. So life eventually becomes a huge bunch of tau integrations and star products. Okay, and the manipulation you'd like to carry out is to take this expression and expand the Wilson line e to the a in powers of a hat. And we'll call Qm the term which comes from the mth power of expanding the Wilson line. Okay, so the term, each of these terms has to have a fixed number m of a hats. It has to have a the original number of operators or I, and they are supposed to be multiplied with each other using the star product, and they are all supposed to be smeared using these integrals in tau. And the claim is beautifully that at the end of the day, the whole thing becomes a commutative product of n plus m objects, which has the name star m plus n. It's the set of star n products which inspired, I guess, Star Trek, among other many other works. Okay. The interesting thing. Okay. So we've introduced this new.
Not a star in Qm of x times e of the ikx.
No, oh. Here it probably doesn't matter. It should be a star in principle, but it doesn't matter because one star you can always remove. Okay. So this product is commutative, unlike the original star product, but it's not associative, also unlike the original star product. Okay, so you have to actually give it by giving all the entries in any order you like and putting one big bracket over everything. We've introduced this notation. I apologize to inventors of other notations, but this will be very useful. These factors theta del come from expanding the Wilson line, because the Wilson line had d xi I by d tau in front of A, and that gives rise to all these derivatives. So we see that these new products have arisen, and the simplest one, called star 2, is the commutative product between F and G given by this. And I don't know if this is a helpful observation, but this sort of parameterizes, if you like, in an abstract way, the relation between the Moyal star and star 2. If you take the Moyal star and scale the parameter theta by a tau, just a scaling factor, add its complex conjugate, no surprise, you've got what you could call the cosine product, because this is an exponential I something, this is e to the minus I, the same thing. So that's like a cosine. Integrating a cosine in d tau will give you sine x upon x, and that is star 2. So that's the kind of manipulation which, if you do several million times, you'll get the entire series that I wrote down on the previous transparency. Okay. Now, much as this looks complicated, it actually, first of all, it's not that, it's a little tedious, but it's a lot of fun actually manipulating these star n products. There are some nice identities between star n and the old Moyal star, which I'm not writing down. But what we are interested to do here is to apply all this machinery, which I hope I've explained or at least summarized, to find gauge invariant Raman-Raman couplings.
These types of star products appear literature previously
to string theory, you mean?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Does anyone know? I have no idea.
Non-commutative geometry.
Excuse me?
In which
time scale
are you?
Any time scale.
They're vaguely reminiscent of the infinity bars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a whole subject called operands.
Probably the first instance where this is vaguely appeared is a paper by Conselli, where he constructed a map to curate two different star products corresponding to different force constructs. That was back in
1995, I guess.
But these are all associative, right?
Although they obey the AM.
This is not associative.
Yeah, this is not associative. No, it's not even clear if it makes sense to ask if they're associative. Because what these things do is mm-hmm. to take several open string operators and then give you something which can couple mm-hmm. to a closed string.
That's right.
It actually gives you a closed string operator.
Good. Okay.
And so that means that you've gone outside the set from which you started, which means that you can't then apply it again. Mm-hmm.
That's right. But I mean, in a very stupid sense, one could ask this question, because there's star 2 and there's star
right.
So you could ask whether
right.
doing star
yeah,
2 and then star 2
paper that star 2 was non-associative, and then later
once you understand that there's star n, then there's not much sense asking the question. I mean, you could do star 2 between a pair of things and then star 2 between the result and another thing, and that's what's not associative. But as he said, what you should do between given three things is star 3 and not star 2 and then star 2 in any case. So it's, in that sense, it's not associative. But okay, I mean, a Poisson bracket is not associative. It's a bit like that as well. It's really a bracket kind of operation. Okay, so according to the way I've outlined the procedure, given a closed string background, what you need to do is first find out what operator it couples to, if it were constant, and then you need to take that operator and smoosh it inside all these star products along with a Wilson loop, and that's the coupling you're supposed to have when the field is spatially varying. So I hope the philosophy is clear. And from what I told you already in the beginning of this talk, the most important thing, the operator that couples to the highest rank Ramon-Ramon form on a brain is just this ratio of Poissons, which can also be written as the square root determinant 1 minus theta f hat. Okay, so this times C10, for example, would have been the coupling on a non-commutative D9 brain if C10 were constant. And the question now is, what if C10 isn't constant? So again, part of the previous summary was that you shouldn't look for any couplings in position space. You should look for them in momentum space. So the question is, what should the Fourier transform C, this is the analog of C10, of minus K, what mode as a function of K on the open string should couple to that? Okay, and this is the operator which would have coupled to it if everything was constant. And following the prescription I explained, we should multiply that with a Wilson loop, insert this inside a box, carry out the prescription called L star, which is to path order and integrate over all the taus, in which every F is smeared and every A inside the Wilson loop is smeared. And once we are done, then we multiply it with e to the I k dot x and integrate.
Okay, I have to make a comment. This is actually a sort of delicate comment to make, because in the end, our result agrees with yours. But nevertheless, I have to ask a question about the procedure. And I'm asking this because this is the kind of question which bothers me for a long time, since the time I had a question about, for example, matrix model in curved space, etc. So in the previous transparency, you pointed out that if you have gauge invariant operator, and then that you have operator O, and if you smear it out in along Wilson line, then you get a gauge invariant operator. And that is clear, and I have no objection about that. But the question is that what kind of operator that you have to choose as pivot O to smear out, and how you smear out, has to be derived. In my talk that I gave at Strings 2001, I gave an example of energy momentum tensor, which a naive application of this procedure gives a wrong result. So it requires some kind of proof that it quite works in the case of Ramon-Ramon field that this procedure works.
Sorry, for the energy momentum tensor, it's a wrong result in the bosonic string?
Well, there are two things. In the bosonic string, it gives a completely different result. In the case of a superstring, if you use then if you look for energy momentum tensor for the constant background and plug that in, you get the right result. However, for example, if you use energy momentum tensor for commutative theory and smear it out, then you get the wrong result. If you start with matrix theory, and as Das and Trivedi were suggesting, and then consider this background which gives a non-commutative gauge theory, you get the right result. So there are some procedures which gives known to give a right result, and there are reasons for that. And there are procedures which give the wrong result. So I think in the case of Ramon-Ramon probe, you need to show really that why this gives the correct result.
Okay. Well, we haven't certainly tried to address that. I mean, what we've actually done operationally is to expand this determinant, and whenever you have any F, you smear it. That's what we've done. So yeah, that's clear.
I agree with the final result, okay. So I don't have any objection about the result itself. I'm just making comments about the procedure.
There could be some subtleties in this.
Well, if I understand right, your only question was how do you know that you're smearing the right operators? And first you derived the operators and then you smeared them, so I don't see what the problem is.
Well, the problem is that he didn't work. I don't want to go into detail, but if I may, how do you know that this was the correct operator?
Well, in the case of constant C, yes, we derived
it. The question is, how do you know that using constant operator, derived operator in a constant field and smear it out is the correct operator? That requires a proof. And in this case, I know it's a correct result, so I'm questioning the fact which is actually correct. But I'm just asking the derivative. How do you show that?
Just so that I understand this, I mean, is the argument, the following was sort of the argument we had at the back of our mind, that let's say somebody gave us the couplings for matrix theory.
Yeah.
Then we just build the non-commutative.
Yeah. I completely agree that this is a correct procedure. And the reason behind that is that DKPS limit and Sen Zeiberg limit is an equivalent limit for that background.
Yeah.
So therefore, if you derive the what we have derived a long time ago, how closed string states coupled to matrix theory variables, and then therefore, if you consider, if you plug that back, this particular background in that formula, you automatically get the discomplete the computation of in the same Zeiberg result, and that's what we did, and we got the same result. So, but I just mentioning that this requires a proof.
Is there so once one knows the couplings in matrix theory? Anyone use it? Is there a further ambiguity?
No, there is no further ambiguity.
No, then I'm confused.
I think that Dadas created the paper was suggesting is a correct procedure.
Yeah. And I thought we followed it. I thought we derived this as what it couples to in matrix theory. And
okay,
then.
What you meant by this is really that this is the operator which couples to matrix theory.
Yes. Okay. That's how we derived it.
Okay, I understand that.
Well, that was the entire content of our first paper.
Yeah,
right?
I think I understand that. Yeah.
Okay, so I hope it's clear what this formula means. This is sort of the most operative formula in this talk, and I understand.
Minus k.
Sorry.
What is c tilde of minus?
It's the Fourier transform of c of x evaluated at minus k, because then we are going to multiply it with something that's at plus k. So it's the coupling of two momentum modes.
K is parallel to the brain.
K is parallel to the brain.
So
everything is parallel.
So c tilde is a field leaving on the brain. You don't.
This is, yes, this is actually the Ramon. So this is, in this case, we're talking of a 9-brain, let's say, with a 10-form field, so it's completely parallel to the brain, and we're not worrying about pullback. So this is just the 9-brain case, which is simplest, but it's enough for a lot of things. That's right. So that's the Fourier transform of the Ramon-Ramon field. That stuff is standard, and this is the instruction to take what in matrix theory the Ramon-Ramon field couples to, multiply by Wilson operator, SNEAR, and take star, SNEAR and order inside this, and the result is a series of star products. Okay. Now that's the answer just for the coupling of a non-commutative 9-brain to the 10-form. On the other hand, in real life, that is in commutative theory, the coupling of a 9-brain to the 10-form C10 is C10. There isn't anything exciting about that coupling at all. Here it is in momentum space. A 9-brain has on its world volume integral C10, and the best you can have is a factor outside parameterizing its charge. There isn't anything else. So this is one expression for a coupling, and this, with a lot of work, is another expression apparently for the same coupling. And there's nothing much for it except to believe that this entire line is equal to delta of k. Okay, and that's quite exciting, because on the one hand, this is a Wilson loop. It depends on A hat, not on F. Of course, it has well-known gauge covariance properties, but it's defined through A hat. This, on the other hand, is a fairly simple determinant involving only F hat and no explicit A hats. If you convolve them using the Liou product, if I may call it that, and Fourier transform, you'll get this. One little comment, by the way. It doesn't mean that if you didn't Fourier transform, you would have got 1. This isn't 1. The reason is that inside the definition of W is a K. You have to define the Wilson line along a straight contour which is parameterized by K. And that K is the K with which you are going to Fourier transform. So it's really the Fourier transform is 1. Maybe there's some nice way to find out what this thing is, but wasn't readily apparent, I should say.
You remove L star of determinants and you get delta of K, because the Fourier transform of exponential is delta.
I'm sorry if I did. No, that's the point, because W depends on K.
So if you just remove a star, remove that term, you would get delta of K.
What term? All this? If I remove this, I get delta of K, that's correct.
So if you insert it, you still get delta of K.
Because it depends on K. That's certainly possible.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, what you can do if you want something that's sort of one is to take all the k's inside here and make them all hit this and convert them back to del by del x, and then make them all go back on that. But inside all the stuff that's going on under L star, it's a hard job, but I don't claim that this is impossible to simplify. In any case, the claim is that this is equal to this, which in explicit language is that. That up there. And one thing you can do, in fact, as well, just pointed out, in a sense, if this wasn't there, we would get delta of k, that's correct. And if a was 0, a hat was 0, then this would be 1 and this would be 1. So in fact, this would not be there and we would get delta of k. So this identity is saying that whatever's on the right side doesn't depend on a hat. That's all it's saying. Okay. And just to give you a small, very small and perhaps misleading flavor of what's involved, to lowest order in A hat, of course, this is 1 minus trace of theta F hat upon 2, and this is 1 plus theta ij del j AI hat, and F is just the abelian F, because that's to lowest order. This is just first order in A hat approximation, and then as you can see, just multiplying these without any fancy products is actually 1. But at the very next order, this has an F squared term, it has an A hat squared term, this has an A hat squared term, and there are star products, star N products between them. Okay. However, with few enough objects, you need few enough star products. That means if you want to work to order A hat squared, you only need to go up to star 2 or maybe 3. Yeah, to A hat squared, you really need only star 2, I think that's correct. And that's when the interesting properties of star become relevant, and so on. Now, as far as proving this directly, one thing we did, and I think that that's quite nice, is that in complete generality, we checked it algebraically to order a hat cubed, which really does mean involve using all the properties of star 2. In addition to that, and I think star 3, I'm getting confused, but I think we needed star 3 also. Sorry?
Does it become independent of a hat before the integral, or only after you do the x integral?
Ah, that's a nice question. Well, you see, what you do, I see. Well, I'll tell you after you do the integral, because what you do, for example, from here, what you'll really get is k and not kj and not del j. Okay, because the Wilson loop has this k dependence, and theta ij kj is the contour along which the Wilson loop lives. And for k to be equal to the del which is inside f, you need for that k to go here and be converted back to a del and come back. So in that sense, you can always just formally substitute k's with dels after you've expanded, but that's equivalent to doing the integral, I believe. Yes. So Jeremy was just going to tell me why we were using star 3 products. Why do we need star 3 products?
Well, when you've got a cubed, then it's star 3 of a cubed.
Yeah.
And then what happens,
okay,
you also got lower order stuff, but then and then there's a recursion relation between star 3 and star 2 that makes it all work.
You know, I realize now what I was confused with is this confusion between 2 and up 2. Which is that 2 order a hat cubed means including terms of order a hat cubed and not up to terms of order a hat cubed. In fact, I had a long debate on this with my student collaborator. So, ended up confusing me. So really, including terms of order, so this is 2 order a hat, and we've checked it to order a hat cubed involving star 2s and star 3s, and it's quite a bit of fun. The other thing we did, which actually is a completely general proof, as far as a hat and theta are concerned, and should be convincing, because the simplification isn't that much. We just assume that there's non-commutativity along a pair of directions. Now, you might say that if there's non-commutativity in 10 directions, I can always go to a basis where, you know, theta is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is true. But unfortunately, you also need q, which isn't necessarily in the same basis. That is, if theta has only components 1, 2, and 3, 4, q may have components 1, 3, or something. And so it's not very easy to decouple all the factors. But if you could, then root det is just a product of simple factors. That's the whole point about the Pfaffian, that in a basis it's just a product of simple factors. And so if you assume this was a D string, the other, a Euclidean D string, let's say, instead of a D9 bin, then indeed this term is just 1 minus theta 1 2 F 2 1. And in that case, we have a complete proof, recursive tedious proof in the appendix, but it's a complete proof. Okay, now you can, of course, the whole issue is what you mean by proof. In some sense, equivalence of commutative and non-commutative couplings is the proof. That's why we got this identity, and if that equivalence holds, then that's the proof. But one likes explicit checks, and so here's the explicit check. Another thing which we noticed is that this identity in this language can be quite easily transcribed into operator language, noting that this is the ratio of the Pfaffian of Q over theta, which is the ratio of the Pfaffian of capital Xi Xj over small Xi Xj. And with a few manipulations, you can get small x's to the other side. And this is the identity in matrix language. It's rather pretty because it just says that if I take these large x's and shrink them till they become small x's, everything's the same, where large x's are defined like this in terms of small x's. You can explicitly see that just evaluating the right-hand side at a hat equals 0 makes the left side.
This is a case of rank 2, okay.
This is not the case of rank 2, is it? Wasn't supposed to be. Why should it be rank 2? No, we didn't prove it. We just wrote it in this form. You proved it.
This identity is true.
Yeah.
I remember it wrong. Is this identity true when I and J goes 1 and 2?
We have the Pfaffian here, right?
Yeah.
So so it is the product of...
Oh, okay, I was ignoring the Pfaffian.
Indeed. So, okay, so we got this far. However, in fact, Okawa and Oguri from this exact form proved the equation by a very elegant method, which is that you differentiate in a small... So you just... This equality amounts to saying that a small variation of capital X gives you 0 on the right-hand side. So just vary capital X. The trick is that you vary it once here, which is relatively simple, and then you have to vary it once up in an exponential, which is inside a symmetrized trace. So they introduce an integral which inserts the variation delta X in the middle of... So you take e to the ik dot x, break it in two pieces, insert in the middle, and then integrate over all ways of breaking it in two pieces. That's something we missed, actually. We were trying to do this, but I have to say we didn't quite succeed. And they did. And then with a little bit of cyclicity of the trace, you eventually get zero. It's a bit scary, I have to say, because at the end you do worry that you might prove almost anything to be zero in this language. I don't know if you felt...
Well, I have to object to that.
Okay.
We are very careful about that.
I have no doubt that you were careful.
I think that the way that you can prove anything is that you assume that you can take trace of commutator of any operator to be equal.
That's right, yeah.
If you assume that trace of commutator of any operator is zero, you can prove any identity, including the identity which is wrong. And but what you can assume is that the commutator which involves the variation vanishes.
That's correct. In fact, your paper states very... Yes, they are.
So what you have to be careful of course, is you're using trace cards
operator. That's right. But I think they stated what they were doing very precisely, and I didn't mean... I wouldn't be scared if I were them. I'm just scared because I'm me. Okay. Now the next step is very interesting. This, if I may remind you, arose from taking the highest Ramon-Ramon form coupling to the brain, so the 10 form if we were on a 9 brain. And now we'd like to look at the 8 form if we were on a 9 brain. And what happens in this case is that in the case of constant fields, as we showed in our previous paper, the form PCP minus 1, so which is 2 dimensions lower than the brain world volume, couples to Q inverse, which comes from expanding and e to the Q inverse that I had written down for you earlier. That's the analog of the wedge B plus F in the commutative story. And then there's this ubiquitous factor that just always appears in these couplings. So that's what it was in the constant case. So again, we just grab this and this and put them inside the Liou bracket. Okay. So the new thing now is that there's a Q inverse which carries two indices which make up the complete set of P plus 1 indices. And now we have to compare with the commutative coupling, this one, where which is just written in momentum space, but all said and done, it's C wedge B plus F. Okay. Now you find that if you massage Q inverse a bit, as I think I've already done, you can get it into this form. And the first term is B. And if you put B, if you take the B term in here, it comes out of the integral since B is constant, and you reduce to our previous identity, delta of K. And because of that, the B on this side and the B on this side actually cancel. So then, you are left with F on this side, and some horrendous function of F hat and A hat on the other side. And when you get that, it's not very surprising what it can be. We already know what relates F to some horrible function of F hat, that's the Seiberg-Witten map. Moreover, it's quite convenient that on this side we just got F, and in a place where we can extract it if we like, because it's just sitting all by itself under a Fourier transform. So we'll get a solved expression for F in terms of something very complicated. Actually, that thing isn't that complicated. All you have to do is take Q inverse and replace it with this second term, just put that in there. And so our proposed Seiberg-Witten map is that. And one way you might like to think of it is that if F were constant, then F hat would also be constant. Then you could pull this outside and all the rest of this stuff is 1, as we've already seen. And that's the well-known Seiberg-Witten map for constant fields for U1. F is F hat over 1 minus theta F hat. So the generalization to non-constant F says that you put this inside this stuff and integrate. So it's an integral expression for the Seiberg-Witten map. Okay. This is only for U1, and it's interesting that precisely this formula was conjectured by Liu, who proved it in small theta, where the Moyal product turns into a Poisson product and everything is much more tractable. And I think that once he arrived at it from that route, he thought, well, this should be the general expression. And of course, he already noted these checks, such as that if F is constant, it's right, and so on. Okay, and he extended the conjecture to UN, which actually I just looked at the paper today, and what he says is it's not completely, totally inconceivable that it extends to UN. So I'm not sure I was very, very confident. But I think more or less the formula makes sense for UN with a few traces here and there. However, our proof certainly works only for U1, and at the moment it's not surprising from the way it came out, because it came out from a Chern-Simons term C wedge F with a single F inside a trace. So for UN, you would at best be able to extract the trace part, which is U1.
Could you remind me how the group interfaces work for UN case? So it's not a trace, right?
Well, there's a trace on it somewhere. Now, I cannot really remember what. In fact, I'm not sure he spelled that out in detail.
Because I'm confused about group index, because F is now adjoint, right?
F is adjoint.
And so it's supposed to transform locally under gauge transformation.
That is so, right.
The left-hand side and right-hand side transforms differently, right? Because right-hand side, you have non-commutative gauge.
That's certainly
so
true, of course.
So how does group index work?
So the group in, let's see, but I mean, even in the U1 case, of course, I mean, the whole thing is gauge invariant in spite of everything transforming inside it, right? So.
Yeah, but in the case of a UN case, you don't take trace of something, right? Because you have to have gauge field F in adjoint representation to be expressed by something.
So I guess this is an untraced Wilson line, right? This is also everything's
but
in
then
the
can action. You integrate over X, the untraced Wilson line over X?
Well, eventually you trace, I guess. Oh, I see what you're saying. I see. You're saying, no, okay, I understand. You integrate the untraced Wilson line over X. Yeah, that is a question that I'm not sure about. Although it might be, instead you have to do something very complicated like take the trace, then the trace of some square, I mean many powers of traces,
I should just look at the paper. Yeah. Did he have trace?
What's the question? The question is,
Is there a trace?
What's the conjecture?
The conjecture is just that the commutative UN field strength on the left hand side is equal to variant.
Which is gauge variant,
Gauge variant.
Yes. Okay.
It's equal to the object on the right hand side, which is the gauge variance.
I think what Hiroshi is saying is
similarly on the gauge transformation is my question.
So f hat and f don't, but once you've done all the manipulations on the right hand side, then they should. In fact, if
you're saying no traces go on the right hand side.
No traces. But so I guess what was worrying Hiroshi and me, but maybe I was wrong to be worried, is the integral of dx over something which has no traces. But maybe it's okay. Maybe it works. I mean, how?
It's a reducible representation in terms of building it up from matrix.
Yes.
It's okay to do the x trace, but not the matrix.
Okay. That is perhaps true. Yes. That is correct. That's a good point.
If you've got a trivial,
that might explain why it's doable. Yes. Okay. So the conjecture is with no traces at all.
Okay. So that's a formulation of the conjecture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's still open. Okay. Okay, so I've already mentioned this about derivative corrections. The statement is that, well, there are no corrections for the top form, the 10 form, which gave that identity. And for the 8 form terms, which gave the Seiberg-Witten equation, there could be derivative corrections which make both sides of this equation unknown.
May I just say that first? In order to extend the conjecture to UN, it is not sufficient to write this equation.
Mm-hmm.
That was my question. Because in that Seiberg-Witten map also, we rate the gauge transformation parameter of commutative.
Yes, that is true.
Gauge transformation parameter of non-commutative system.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, one has to show how the non-commutative gauge transformation parameter transforms from one to the other in order to claim that this is.
Yeah, well, as I said,
only in one case, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in your case, it doesn't appear in the equation.
In one case, the left-hand side is gauge invariant. So
you don't have to know it.
You don't
the right-hand side is gauge invariant. You don't need the map of gauge transformation.
Well, I'm pretty sure, I mean, that it was not pursued that far.
So I was confused that how can that work, that if you assume a very complicated transformation between the gauge transformation parameters, then that something like that.
Well, that's also a part of the Seiberg-Witten map, as you say, and we also know that to low orders. So, for example, one could check whether this expression in low orders in A hat works with the known map between parameters.
Let me say one more thing, which is that the computation you've been describing actually shows that in the general UN case, if you do take traces of both sides, that formula is now true.
Yeah,
that is correct.
And so what that means is, and now both sides, now the left-hand side is gauge invariant.
That's right.
Which means that the thing inside the trace must transform as some U itself.
But you have just one information out for N square. You need N square identity, whereas you only have one identity. So how can you deduce the N square identity out of one? You can deduce N square identity out of one identity.
Right, but So it's not clear that actually proves it, but it does show that it's certainly consistent.
Well, it's a reasonable conjecture, but you have n square minus 1 degrees of freedom to modify the conjecture.
But are those n squared minus 1 things actually there, or are they just field redefinitions?
Yeah, sure.
So you can ask the
question. I'm just asking the formulation of the concept.
Suppose we take this the question is, given this relation, is it possible to find a relationship between the gauge transformation parameters?
Yes.
Where both sides transform as adjoints, right?
That's right.
So that way, that n square minus 1 extra constraints may be the freedom of redefining gauge transformation.
It's possible.
Yeah. Right.
It's not a proof, but Morita equivalence strongly suggests that this is right.
Morita equivalence strongly suggests that this is right. Yeah.
Just to ask, so I understand it. You could construct the UN theory also starting from D-intensity matrix theory, right? And then you would get an operator, a correspondence like this. Then consistent with the sort of general philosophy you've been following, you would get a relation like that.
We would get C wedge trace of all this stuff, right? This Chern-Simons term has a trace. And we're only comparing Chern-Simons terms after tracing. That is sort of the problem. But, okay. So this comment was just to say that the comparison we made for the case which gave us this formula was between a non-commutative and a commutative Chern-Simons term, both of which are actually unknown up to a field redefinition of here A and here A hat. But that's exactly the ambiguity built into the Cyber-Guitton map, so we shouldn't be surprised. So in that sense, there isn't any additional ambiguity. Okay. Now I want to actually talk about something that's quite intriguing and slightly different from, well, it's an obvious extension of what we've done, which is transverse scalars. So now we would build up a D-brain which isn't, let's say, a 9-brain, but maybe a 7-brain, and it has at least two transverse directions. And as we've learned in recent times, there are several ways in which the Chern-Simons terms and also the DBI action depend on these scalars. One is just the fact that a spatially varying Ramon-Ramon field depends on the matrices themselves and can be expanded as a kind of non-abelian Taylor expansion, or dare I say a Washington Taylor expansion, sorry, with phi I del I evaluated at x equals 0. That's one form of dependence. The second form of dependence is that there's this P symbol which sits outside everything, and just as an example, when it acts on C with all the indices, actually I've probably written this in a way that Myers wouldn't like. He would have put the indices outside, because you have to project and then put the indices. That's the whole point. And it says that, well, you take the Ramon-Ramon field with its indices all along the brain world volume, but then also allow indices to be outside and project it back by a derivative of the scale transverse scalar. So that's another form of dependence. And then of course these on which we've already focused, commutator terms. So in principle one should, as you've seen already, I've been examining comparison between bits and pieces of the non-commutative and the commutative Chern-Simons, and you could just keep running it through focusing at different times on different ones of these terms. So I'll just show you an example which focuses once on these two and then once on the commutator, and we'll see that one way we get an identity which is again a Cyber-Guitton type map, and the other way we get an identity which again says that something is topological. So first let's note that since C is supposed to depend on these matrices through this non-abelian Taylor expansion, here what I've written is just what I wrote earlier as e to the phi del acting on C. I've expanded it out and here's the first order term, and now we have to understand that phi is a matrix. Okay. And Q is just the coefficient of the linear term coupling phi with C, and it's interpreted as the momentum along the transverse directions. Probably this should have been zero here. Okay, the momentum along the directions transverse to the brains. Now, supposing we go back to our prescription, we should ask where can we get... Sorry.
Why should it have been zero? I thought
it's written
correctly.
Oh, is it? Mm. I'm trying to expand.
Then I misunderstood. Don't you want to take the cues for your?
Maybe it is written correctly.
Yeah, is there a space, right?
Well, what I'm trying to expand is this. I'm just having a momentary blackout. This. Yes, I'm sorry. No, it is Q. It's not zero. It's zero in position space, of course. That was my blackout. Okay, so this is correct. And we're going to focus on the term which is linear in phi and has a Q multiplying it. And the question is, if so this is commutative, but for many, if you like, for one or many D-brains, if there are many, then this is a matrix. And what we want to compare this with is what you get starting with the constant, the coupling of the Ramon-Ramon field when it's constant, which we already know, and then introducing a Wilson line, but this time the Wilson line should have momentum in the transverse direction. And it's well known that to the usual open Wilson line, you can always add this, which incorporates all the transverse scalars, and QA is the momentum along the transverse direction. Okay. So this Wilson line has an expansion in terms of star n products. The only new thing is that now you have a bunch of A's and a bunch of phi's, such that the total number should add up to m at each level. And whenever there are A's, then there are derivatives, but whenever there are phi's, then there are Q's. That's quite straightforward. And now what you can do, I don't think I'm going to run through all the details, but just follow what we did before, expand this Wilson line, but keep the first order in phi and therefore in Q, and keep all orders in A hat, and compare to Q phi from there. And you have to get some sort of map which relates the abelian to the non-abelian, sorry, the commutative to the non-commutative scalar. And here it is to a few low orders. Actually, we probably could get a more interesting closed form looking expression, but this is it to a few orders. And I think there might be a typo. There should perhaps be a half in that term. In any case, this is a Seiberg-Witten map between commutative and non-commutative scalar fields, and what's nice is that now it's not a map of field strengths as the one we found earlier, it's really a map of the field itself. Okay, and as I said, it's not ruled out that you could have a nice integral representation, but I've just chosen to pull out a bunch of terms for you. And you can compare this with the Seiberg-Witten map obtained from A hat by a dimensional reduction pulling out one of the scalars. So that's one little result that concerns transfer scalars. I'll be done in a few minutes now. The other application is something I had already promised. To do this, let me again be very specific. Let's take matrices and build up a Euclidean D-string and look at its coupling to the Ramon-Ramon 4 form, the thing that shouldn't be there if I have a single Euclidean D-string, but should be there if I have more than one. So here's the matrix model term relevant to us, and we'll choose phi 1 is x1 and phi 2 is x2, while the other phi's will be renamed phi hat and will become transverse scalars. And so you just have to put in these solutions in all the possible places, and you get one term with xx and phi phi and another term with x phi and x phi. I remind you that x's are the ones which commute to q, while phi are the transverse matrix scalars. Okay, and then of course these we already know to do. X with phi is interpreted as a covariant derivative of phi, and x with x is of course q12 in components, it's just that, and the whole operator in question turns into this. So this is the generalization, if you like, of what the Ramon, this is what the Ramon-Ramon 4 form couples to in the case of constant field strengths. And this is already a paradox because this should be zero. In fact, I could probably just tell you the answer right now. It is zero up to total derivative terms because for constant, so this bracket multiplies this actually, but if I take the one from here, then this and this add up to zero in the approximation when phi is linear in x, which is the DBI approximation. Okay, because then the star product only gives you its first term and all other terms are zero. And then you have only f hat, and that's just a total derivative because f hat is also del of a and a is linear in x. So that's how this is zero in constant fields. What's much more non-trivial is that it should be zero for variable fields. And that's the identity. So you just take that operator, fold it with a Wilson line, put it inside L star, and you should get 0. And it's again topological in the sense that if I put phi equals 0, then this is 0. So if you can show that this is independent of phi, then you've shown that it's 0. And it should be possible, we simply haven't done it, to rewrite this identity in operator form and maybe use the techniques that they use to prove this result. But again, we have explicit proofs for this to all orders, because remember this is a D-string, so for this case we are explicit proof works fine, and it's reassuring that we get this. The other thing I've already said, oh, there's one more thing. Supposing I had used matrix theory to make not one D-string but n D-strings, then of course there should be a coupling to the transverse scalars, between the transverse scalars and the 4 form, and we know what that coupling should be, so that would be here on the right side. and the non-abelian version on the left, and we'd have some more identities. So I think I sense that fatigue is setting in. I'll skip the non-BPS stuff. You can read it, and I'll just conclude. So, well, about this, I just want to say that in retrospect, it was obvious. Once you've done it, it's obvious that you should get the Cyber-Guitton map from this, because what else can you get if you compare f and a function of f hats? But we also got this identity that 1 is equal to something and 0 is equal to something, and it's not obvious to me at all that we have scraped out this particular barrel carefully. There could be a lot of new things, and they seem to have some bearing on the ideas of Concevich, which have been mentioned here about deformation, quantization, equivalent and non-equivalent Poisson structures, and so on. Now actually Leon Michelson's paper, is going to come out soon, and it has a very nice description of description dependence in this problem. What I've done is, capital phi dependence. We've been working at phi equals minus b, which arises naturally in the matrix model. I have to say that my collaborator has been working on description dependence for some time, and I'm not sure where he's reached, but he has, I think, has some results which might be overlapping with William Michelson paper, but hasn't written them yet. Disk amplitude calculations, I'm told, are to appear in Star Trek 3. And we have done some of this for non-BPS brains. Of course, it's never clear how much you should expect to work for non-BPS brains from matrix theory, but these are just simple non-BPS, not even brain anti-brain pairs. But whatever we did, including finding the Cyber-Guitton map for the tachyon, seems to work out right. So I'll close there.
Any questions?
What is it? How much can you or anyone else say about couplings to the NSNS fields? I mean, one question which is, of course, of great interest in the NSNS case is what the quadratic couplings to the background fields are. Identities you might get from non-commutative geometry that would constrain those.
That's very interesting. I don't know. Sandeep, you have anything to say about that?
Linear couplings to the NS fields can be worked out first.
Right. They want quadratic.
Is there a problem working out the quadratic couplings in matrix theory?
Yes, we have to do a two-loop calculation, which nobody's ever done. I mean, you have to do a general UN two-loop calculation, which, you know, Akawa and Yunea did a very nice U3 two-loop calculation, but you would have to generalize that to UN. And, you know, that'll give you some hints of the non-abelian Born infill at higher orders.
Quadratic coupling means two closed ring states?
That's right.
So, that can be expressed not in terms of Wilson line, but actually some of Wilson line, Wilson curves. So it's some kind of passive integral of Wilson curves. So if you have, say, closed ring state with momentum this way, if you have closed ring state momentum this way, and then you consider rectangle, then not rectangle, but parallelogram. And then there are sort of family of Wilson lines, Wilson curves, which connect between them, and you have to superimpose them. And then that will give you an operator which coupled to two closed ring states. And if you have three, you consider it's a three-dimensional body, and you consider some of all possible curves which pass through you. And that gives you a three-point coupling.
Why is that the correct prescription and not just taking a Wilson line?
I derive that from this amplitude. I can derive that. So you just compute this amplitude with two closed ring states, or three closed ring states. And you see that the momentum works out so that you sum over these parts.
Now, the reason why I was asking is because there's a physical description that you can have for why the Wilson line is the correct description for coupling to closed ring operators, and not some sort of more general curve. And that's the fact that if you look at the open string oscillator expansion, the strings are actually separated. The endpoints of the string are actually separated by precisely the theta k that appears in the separation in the displacement of the Wilson line. And then, so then when you take alpha prime goes to zero, then of course the open string doesn't oscillate, and so it's a straight line connecting those two points.
But here we are considering alpha prime correction to that. And so the other more technical way that the open Wilson line appears, that if you consider two-point amplitude of closed string in the bulk and open string on the boundary, then in the alpha prime goes to zero limit, it gives a linear map. and it gives a linear map which goes from 0 to 1, as open string goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. Mm-hmm. And it becomes maximum at the place where it becomes half at the place where closed string, real part of the closed string coincides with the location of open string. Now, if you have two of them, then it sort of goes to 0 to 1, but in a different way, and depending on the relative location of closed string. And then they come with different direction of momentum, then it starts going this way. And you can describe that by considering in 10 dimensions. So it's more complicated, it has more complicated research. I'm not sure whether I'm helping you.
Yeah, I mean, you can use that to make some explicit statement about what the quadratic couplings to say the metric is.
Well, I have this formal expression, but I'm not sure how you can make it.
I mean, there should be some operator which couples to derivative of the metric times derivative of the metric, right? Which, as you know from studying matrix theory and curved backgrounds, would be very nice, you know, should obey these axioms. You can't go directly from your formal expressions to this kind of operator.
Well, it should obey the geodetic conditions, etc., I believe.
Good. Any more questions or comments? Okay, let's go.